This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike, and just before we dive into a fantastic episode, I want to tee you up that after the show, I'm going to say a little about a couple of exciting London FinTech podcast initiatives that folks have been requesting from me for some time. But first, an absolute cracker of a show. Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast episode 45, where we've just stepped out of Finovate, and I'm delighted to welcome Stephen Dubois, founder and CEO of Exignite, on the show today to take a deep dive into APIs, which are not only the very building blocks of much of FinTech, but also set to become even more important with forthcoming legislation around opening up banking data. Exignite is a decade-old company, focuses on market data, and is one of the leading providers of financial APIs in the world, with more than 1,000 clients in over 50 countries. And they anticipate that in the first half of this year, they will do a staggering 1 trillion API calls. They must have a computer running full-time just to count that number. So what are all the facets to APIs? Why is something so techie of such importance? It seems to me, although no doubt, as usual, I'll be corrected by the real expert, that there are 5 major facets on the API diamond. The first is technical, second practical, third how they are used, fourth what they enable, and fifth where they are going. Just touching on the technical, the shiny-shoed boys and girls in the front row will know that API stands for Application Programming Interface. No poetic excess there. Computing makes massive use of functions, so just as you can press square root on your calculator, you can do the same in code. Or perhaps more interesting, in effect, have a button on your calculator that says direct line car insurance quote, which takes things like your age, registration number, make model, postcode, and returns not the square root of 4, but, well, I guess an insurance quote. It's a bit like being able to turn a web page into a button on your calculator. So for example, you can also API into YouTube, and in the middle of your web page, see a YouTube video. We'll dive into other facets of APIs in the show. But for now, it's enough to know that APIs are the Lego bricks from which a huge amount of fintech functionality is built. So that's ultra high level. But of course, the devil is always in the detail. What makes someone's API better than someone else's? How can companies own APIs? If they are as simple as I describe above, then surely Direct Line and YouTube own their own API. Where do they run? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Stefan. Thanks for joining me in this slightly noisy room today.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having me on the show, Mike. Listen, I've never thought of APIs as diamonds. You bring a whole new perspective here, but I think you're right. APIs are forever.
Oh, no. As we're talking about a trillion, you're the only person in the world that's going to end up with a trillion diamonds at this rate. So as the sharp-eared listeners might detect, although you're firmly West Coast American these days, maybe you weren't always there. So what's your personal journey been from the sort of the womb to the API diamond mines, skipping over the bit where you're a baby and crying all night?
Sure. I do fool people a little bit. I'm actually French, right? People expect that French will speak English with a very, very, very strong accent, and I fool them a little bit there. But I was born in Brittany, Little Brittany, not the Great Britain, where we are here today.
We're less great than we were, but that's another story in another podcast entirely. We do own the Isle of Wight, but that's about it.
So, I'm Celtic in background, and we may have something in common, I grew up in France, and I went to the U.S. for business school, like many people.
So what age did you emigrate or escape?
It was grad school, so early 20s, and I decided to stay. I was supposed to go back.
But I thought France didn't like America.
Well, I was one of those exceptions who just wanted to love that country for everything it had to give. And so did a business degree there, and little did you know, I was on my way to Silicon Valley getting my first job at Oracle.
And they also have very nice wine on the West Coast, so it's not that unfamiliar.
I got married in Napa, It's good. So yeah, I started Silicon Valley, early 90s, and stayed there through the first internet bubble, if you want. Lived through all this. Got a little specialized in financial services in the late 90s. I worked for a company that did a portfolio management software, if you want. And then I decided to start this company with the focus initially on wealth management. Somehow I thought it was a good idea to try to help people manage money at the time. And it didn't work at all. Couldn't sell our wealth management solutions for the life of us. And it's really by accident we fell into doing market data because we needed market data to power our own solution.
Yeah, it's a classic entrepreneurial story that you have one idea and it's, I'm sure, a good idea and I'm sure you have good products, but you find that people don't exactly treat your product like a painkiller. They can say, oh, that's a nice vitamin, and you've got to persuade them taking vitamins is a good idea. But along the way, you've got a splitting headache, which is not just how to sell that product, but also actually how to build that product. And so you solve that headache, and then you find that, funnily enough, actually, that that's the kind of painkiller that other people will buy much more than your vitamins.
Well, and even then, we were quite early with the concept of APIs. Back in the 2005, 2006, it was still early. You had to explain people what it was. But it's ironic that today, especially in the last 2-3 years, we've been powering tons of fintech companies. We were at Finovate here, a lot of our clients, robo advisors, trading platform, wealth management companies. We've been powering all of those with those APIs. So initially we failed as a wealth management platform. We learned, we got into the API business, and now we're powering all those next generation wealth management platforms. So it's kind of a cool place to be, I would say.
It's interesting because it's amazing how long these kind of revolutions take. And I was just thinking of my partner who took another long podcast short, has been pioneering so-called smart working in the civil service, by which one means less sort of command and control from the center. You don't have to sort of sit there and do what you're told. You're delegated stuff and you can work anywhere. All these kind of more modern working practices. She co-wrote a book about 10 years ago. And 10 years later, she's still giving lectures on what the basic thing is. And so here you are, as you say, 10 years ago, you're having to explain to people what an API is. And now there's some idiot like me saying, oh, so what is an API then? I've heard it's something newfangled. And a bit like the Beatles, it took them 10 years to be an overnight success.
Well, many technologies are rooted into much older things, right? The technical foundation for APIs was laid down in the late 90s. You had HTTP, you had some new protocols that were built that essentially are used today. It took 15 years for it to mature so that it could be used today.
Yes, and I wonder whether part of that was the fact that the internet design, or certainly web design, was a cheap and shoddy thing in the first place, in that it got stripped down so it actually worked. And so all these ideas of semantic web weren't there, because it's really just a syntactic web. And therefore, you have to layer another technology on the top, which enables me to use the YouTube page or your page to kind of create my own web stuff.
Well, yeah, I think the way we like to think about it is like major waves of technology evolution. Before I even started my career, you had mainframes, right? Then you had mini
I worked on an IBM 360 at college.
I did work for a mainframe company in the 90s as well. They did go under. But then you had client servers. So I worked at Oracle. We had databases. We started building applications on this. That took, that 10 years, 15 years
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you had the web, right? Browsers and servers. It started in the mid-90s, but it went on until 2010, still today. And if you look at API and service orientation and the cloud, that's the next generation. So the technology was laid down 15 years ago. But now we're starting to really get into that acceleration phase where people are going to be rewriting all their applications, all their technology stack using those technologies. And that's, I think we're in that turning point.
I guess the parallel between this API and the smart working that I was thinking, which is that it's a bit like dropping a large stone into a pond, the ripples spread out and over time cover more and more of an area, but they take time to spread out and take time to permeate the thing. And very similarly with fintech, there's perhaps a little bit of a lull in the moment in certainly the disruptive fintech, but the waves are still spreading out further. So perhaps it's good to dive into some of these different angles on APIs, as just technically, maybe you can just correct what I was saying at the beginning or agree with it in part or entirely, in terms of how you explain APIs to non-techie people who can understand fintech but actually have just got developers doing that kind of thing. So what is an API as you see it?
Well, an API is just a simple way to do things over the internet. And I think I'll use just an analogy that people typically get. It's like the difference between staying home and cooking a meal, right, where you're going to have to buy all the stuff that you need to cook the meal, have all the tools, spend a lot of time doing the cooking, versus just going to the restaurant and ordering it as a service. And the API is the menu. You know how to, hey, a menu, I can order the appetizers, the entree. I'm going to pay for every dish that I have. Somebody has the whole kitchen, the whole infrastructure behind. They've bought all the supplies and high scale. They can deliver that to me as a service much better than I could do myself. Now, if I want to get a very simple meal, maybe I can cook it myself. But yep. If I want something more elaborate, I can get that as a service. And so what you're seeing today is APIs, which are advanced services being offered over the internet so that when you build a piece of software, which is your meal, You don't have to necessarily write everything from the top to the bottom. Instead, you can essentially order the pieces, right? Yep. So that's a little bit what APIs are, and more firms are okay using some third-party services to build their applications upon. That's what it is.
So that's very clear. And before we get into the practical thing, so I get the metaphor. So non-metaphorically, what might an API be in practice? What's your hit API at the moment? What's the top of the call charts?
APIs are great for simply getting data, right? If you need data that you don't have yourself, you're going to need to get it from somebody else. Yeah. And especially if this data changes a lot, like quotes in the markets, an API is great. Yeah. So when you talk about real-time data, using an API is just the perfect scenario. Because real-time data, it's the kind of meal that's really hard to cook. You need a lot of expertise.
So for example, if I write up some show notes on this, and in the middle of the show notes I say, as you, the reader, are reading this, the FTSE All Share Index is currently at this value. I would stick in an API call to Xignite, and they would send me back the value of it.
Exactly.
Which would update whenever anybody presses refresh on the page. So that's an example. Okay, so then moving on to the practical facet of the diamond. So that's actually what they are. So practically speaking, how do people use them then? Maybe a bit more on the technical thing first. So an API is that, but computer code has to run on a computer somewhere. And we were talking a little bit yesterday about the cloud, and one of the more interesting technical things I heard recently was someone saying, we spent a long time explaining to the client what the cloud was and all that kind of stuff, and they thought they completely got it. And then a bit later we said, there's no such thing as the cloud, there's only other people's computers.
I think there's a fundamental difference. I'm going to use another analogy. The cloud is a utility, is a computing utility. So what people used to do before is they went in their house, and to generate power in their house, they had a generator in their garage, right? You have your generator, you have to bring it in, you have to feed gas into it, or petrol, whatever you call it here, to make it work, right?
Petroleum essence.
This is your hardware, your stuff, and you get your power. Now, plugging your house on your neighbor's generator is not what the cloud is. The cloud is a utility, which is behind, that has power plants, a whole infrastructure that can run 24/7. Which you can plug into with a standard, which is the plug in the wall, right? It's different in the UK than in the US, but it's a standard. You plug it, you can get all the power you want, you just pay for what you consume.
So for example,
that's a utility.
So for example, with Amazon as an example. So Amazon basically fronted up as a utility, but of course behind there, they've got lots of power plants, lots of computers and all that kind of stuff running it. But you don't really need to know about that detail because it's just obscured from you.
It's not somebody else's computer. Somebody else's computer would be somebody else's generator in their garage.
Yeah.
This is the utility, the power utility that has a whole infrastructure. You don't even need to know anything about it. You just plug and pull.
So keeping it simple, is it true to say that Xignite's APIs are on the cloud? And if so, whose cloud, or is it your cloud? Or
when we say cloud, generally we mean the public cloud, and public cloud means Amazon, because they're 10 times bigger than everybody else combined. So from a scale standpoint, from a simplicity to just winning, think of it as an operating system. That's the operating system we use. So yeah, we run on the Amazon. Without Amazon, we could not serve a trillion API requests. We would have to constantly be buying hardware, and it wouldn't be impossible for us to keep up with the demand of what our customers are wanting from us. So yes, we run on Amazon, and to go from 500 billion to a trillion, we just turn a few knobs.
And pay a bit more money.
And actually, the more we buy, the cheaper it gets.
Right. That's a good scaling way. Okay, so I get that in terms of what the API is, how they actually operate, and you know what the cloud is, and how the computers are behind it. So just taking the Xignite case we mentioned before about market data, so the API is on the cloud, so where's the market data? Is that also in the cloud?
Well, we have to get it from other sources, from the exchanges, from vendors, and so we collect them through non-cloud sources, but we bring it in the cloud and we put it there so that everybody can just consume it, right? It's like, again, the power plant. You know, we get raw material and we put it and we turn that into electricity that you can just keep pumping and pumping on.
You were talking before about mainframes, which is a phrase I haven't heard for a long time, but just thinking of my days when I was doing computer science, and we had an IBM 360 at Cambridge, and there was a whole priesthood and air conditioned rooms and all that kind of stuff. And going back to client server stuff, you'd actually just sit on a sort of little terminal to access this sort of great beast of a machine. And then, of course, we go back to laptops, and you've got a nice laptop there. But in a way, metaphorically speaking, the whole thing's gone full circle, because it may be virtual, but there's a huge IBM 360 sitting there with all of the stuff in it.
It is a very big IBM 360.
Yes,
a very, very, very big. It's actually a network of IBM 360s all connected together, and you don't even need to know what it is. Yeah. You don't really need to know that. So there's layers. You know, it is a shared, mutualized infrastructure like an old mainframe, yep. But there's a level of abstraction and a level of simplification that just didn't exist back in those days.
No, indeed. Well, fortunately, all the IT engineers have been kept employed by the fact that it actually is harder to run than one would think. So moving on to the question of how they're used, I saw an article you'd written a little while ago about API supermarkets, so you're pushing your trolley around and fill up your trolley with APIs and you check out. And apparently they didn't catch on particularly well, and you were talking about something about an inch deep, mile wide or something. So what's all that about? So how do people actually shop through a catalogue? I mean, you've got thousands of APIs, so that should sort of sit there and page down until they find one. Oh, we like Square Root, or we like FTSE All Shared thing.
Sure. Well, I mean, people used to write software from the bottom up, as I said earlier. And now they're willing to consume APIs and services. But what they like to do is go to a place where everything they need is available. API supermarkets, which is something you're just talking about, where a concept that was developed in the early days of APIs, where it's like, we're going to have a catalog of, you can buy, you know, weather data and sports data and a little bit of financial data and all kinds of things. So you'd have completely unrelated data sets. The problem with that is that it was not a full solution, right? So if you're a fintech company and you want to build a new wealth management platform, new trading platform, you gotta have all the data you need. If you go to a supermarket and all they sell you is ketchup and mustard, then you don't have all the other things that you need to prepare your meal, you're not gonna go there, right? And so what you have to have is a full solution, means 1 mile deep, not something that's 1 mile wide and only gives you a few things. So what we did is focusing on market data. Market data is a huge market. Yep. It's $25 billion spent globally on data. There's a lot of different pockets of people looking for information about the market. What we created is not only a lot of APIs, but covering broad universe of data so that if I'm trying to build a new fintech application, everything I need is there, all integrated in one place. Supermarkets didn't give you that. They only gave you a little bit and didn't work, didn't catch on.
Okay, so that's how I'd find your APIs, and I'd flick through and find the ones I want, and no doubt there's some pricing mechanism behind it. So in terms of quality, we were just talking there about quantity of APIs. In terms of quality, I guess this question may be a very simple one and very easy answer, but so what makes one API better than another?
Good question. It's interesting. The one main factor in adoption of APIs, and obviously with, you know, 500 billion or so, we know a little bit about adoption of APIs, it's simplicity. It's just how easy it is for the developer to use and integrate. It's like a website, same idea. You can create a bad API. You can create, especially if you take some data that you've got and or some mainframe data, for God's sake. You expose that and you say, go and consume it. If you don't think about how the user is going to consume it, if you don't engineer it for usability, you're not going to get adoption. And there's been a lot of APIs built, a lot of them not usable. They don't get used. You don't have no adoption from it. So building things with the developer in mind, with them and what applications they're going to need to build and how they're going to integrate that is very critical.
So there's usability. And coming back to the cloud thing, because I don't understand these kind of things, is there not a latency issue there? So if, you know, Amazon's got a computer in Seattle for the sake of argument and I press my button, it's going to take a little while for the electrons to run all the way to Seattle and back.
Well, yes, there is. So certainly, you know, using APIs wouldn't work to do like high frequency trading where you need nanosecond response or things like that. But for most web, mobile type or enterprise application, it works well. And Amazon is actually also a global infrastructure. So you have you can have servers in the UK or in Asia or in South America or several parts of North America, so you can serve the data from not too far away and get proper performance that way. So it is a very distributed infrastructure and a very global infrastructure. So, you know, we're finding that with technology getting bigger, better, with the scale getting better, it's possible to do things with APIs that before you would have had to have your own infrastructure. It's getting better, there's more adoption. But APIs are everywhere, by the way. there's a phone on this table where we're talking. All the data that's coming to your phone, all the mobile information is coming through APIs. You know, it's around us. Internet of Things, you know, all these devices connected to the internet, they all communicate via APIs. Cars communicate via APIs.
So a different metaphor would be like a docking port. When you're sticking those sticky bricks together or something like that, API is a way that things stick to each other.
Things communicate, right? It's a simple way for those things to communicate, where I can be writing this application and somebody else wrote the other part, and we're actually different companies, different systems, but we can actually talk to each other.
So this moves nicely, and before people think it's the London Computing Podcast, this moves nicely for those business people who are having trouble keeping up into, that's very interesting, what they are, but actually what do they enable? So we discuss what they are. So what do they enable? As you say, they're used in a lot of fintech. You know, what kind of fintechs are sort of deeply embedded in this, and wouldn't, and what parts of the fintech revolution wouldn't really exist unless APIs did?
Well, one of the first robo-advisors, which is one of our clients, Wealthfront, their CEO, who founded the company many years ago, said that the whole business was enabled by APIs. For him, it was enabled by trading APIs, where they were able to trade using those, exchange-traded funds, which made passive investment possible, but also market data APIs. Without those APIs, they wouldn't have been able to create this robo-advisor, this concept that is taking the world by storm. Why is that? Well, because they would have spent all their time and money figuring out how do we trade and how do we get the market data and build the infrastructure to even be able to advise customers. And they would not have been able to spend the time and effort reinventing advice so that it can be done by a machine instead of an advisor. So they were able to reinvent financial advice. And it took a lot of trial and effort for them. It was all focused on the customer, on the experience. And this is, I think, what has happened, unfortunately, in financial services since the big mortgage crisis. All the banks have been focused on regulations and dealing with the consequences of that. They almost forgot they had customers.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the fintech companies didn't have to worry about infrastructure and regulation and things like this. They leveraged APIs and they completely reinvented the customer experience. So what do they enable? They enable customer satisfaction. They enable serving people in ways that didn't exist before. If you cannot step on the shoulders of others, you're not going to be able to invent anything new. So we're stepping on the shoulders of Amazon. We bring market data there, and you have new companies that step on our shoulders using our data and Amazon to create new things. It's an ecosystem where we all build and invent on top of each other.
No, that's interesting. And I think the one thing that you say that I hadn't particularly thought through myself in all of that was that historically speaking, the bulk of the programming, or coding as the awful word is these days, the bulk of the programming work was really in doing the internals. And that was very, very hard. So you spent so much time on doing that. You got the last 2% of the project to put a nice glossy front end on. But if the inside bit starts becoming quotes easy, unquotes, you can actually devote your effort onto the consumer facing bit, and hence you can get all these lovely interfaces that fintechs have, which makes them so much more usable.
Exactly.
Okay, so just wrapping up APIs, so we're talking about where we've got to now. We're talking about the fact that stones get dropped into large ponds and the ripples keep spreading and spreading, and they're still spreading at the moment. As an API expert, where do you think they're going in the next 5 years? What kind of things are like over the horizon of over the horizon?
Well, I mean, we think API is part of the cloud and service orientation technology wave, right? Think about it, since the web came around in 1995, large organizations, firms at large, have rewritten everything for the web. All their software that used to be client server, whatnot, has been rewritten. The same thing is going to happen with APIs, with the cloud, with this next generation user interfaces and whatnot. So what we see happening for the next 5 to 10 years is everything being rewritten. Anything that especially faces users, customers, professionals, the backend stuff might still be on mainframe for what we know. But the front end is going to all get rewritten. And that means that all the software that we're going to use every day is going to be this beautiful layer of colors that we use in our mobile phone and a whole bunch of APIs underneath. APIs providing storage, for providing processing, providing data, providing calculations, everything's going to move to the cloud. We just announced at Finovate today a new type of APIs we created, which we call Cloud Alerts, which is a way for a bank to implement some alerts notifications in an application just using an API. Before that, they would have had to build the whole infrastructure, parse all the data, take all the feeds, process millions of transactions and whatnot, to simply notify you that your favorite stock just broke, you know, a price point and you should buy it.
So metaphorically speaking, talking about phones, I get a little green box on the top of my phone when I get an SMS text in. So it's the same kind of thing. I get a little bit of blue thing which says, oh, BP has just gone past sort of, you know, £100 going on the down. Do you want to sell or buy?
And to be able to do that for hundreds of thousands of people, it's a lot of infrastructure. Only the cloud is actually capable of doing that. So what we'll see is a lot of the functionality, a lot of the code, a lot of the features are going to move down to the cloud, down into the API infrastructure with multiple layers of technology providing different layers of service. We are focusing on market data. Anything market data will do. We're trying to do. But it's, again, it's an ecosystem that is intertwined, if you want.
Absolutely. So it's a good point to move on to Xignite. As you mentioned, you came out with your new announcement of API alerts, or whatever the official phrase is, this morning. So maybe you'd like to tell us about, you know, what's hot in Xignite at the moment, and where you're going in 2016, and what do you need more of? I mean, there should be 2,000 odd people around the world listening to this. If some of those are potential sort of customers, clients, you know, what kind of things do you want?
Sure. Well, I mean, we, our customers, and we have more than 1,000 of them, are either technology companies operating in financial services or outside financial services that have software that consume data, essentially. Or they are banks or financial institutions at large who themselves write software that consume data. And typically they use us because they build something new, something that they want to be able to innovate. They want to not have to deal with this old legacy infrastructure. So as they write new applications, new services, new platform, they're going to look at us to essentially deliver the data they need to serve those customers. 2016 for us is really the year of helping those financial institutions, those larger banks, who are seeing the fact that they need to get onto the cloud, that they need to reduce their cost structure, because some of them are struggling and they understand there'll be pressure on prices and fees and things like that. They cannot do business as usual, right? So they have to look at everything they do and how to do it and see if they should change it. And market data and the underlying infrastructure is part of it. So what we want more of is banks, as they build new applications, say, let's not tap into our old stuff, the old mainframe, the old infrastructure, but let's move to the cloud, let's use APIs so that we can innovate and save boatloads of money.
A couple of things just spring to mind, and you must hear it all the time in terms of that argument. The first one is, I've heard that, you know, in terms of you've got your historic stack of IT in a bank or whatever, you can put a nice shiny coat around it, but it's still got the old stack, and that's not going to compete with a fintech if it's still sort of converting things into pounds, shillings and pence in the UK on a mainframe in COBOL right in the beginning, if it's got a nice shiny API. So that's obviously one challenge to them. And then the second one is, by now getting a bit of an old subject, but you do still hear it all the time, which is, oh, but isn't the cloud low security? How do you address these issues?
Well, I think you always hear that. I think obviously banks are regulated. They have to make sure that their infrastructure, you know, is safe. They have to respond to the regulator. But in truth, I think we've reached a tipping point. That is, if you look at Amazon, the scale of their infrastructure and the level of cost and of security and reliability that they've achieved, they're way past what any bank can do.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, and banks are still going down and still getting broken into. So we're talking about a mutualized infrastructure. We're talking about one infrastructure that everybody can share. There's really not a lot of value for every bank in the UK and the US getting the same data from the same sources, storing it all over again, spending millions of your money, by the way, as a consumer, just doing things in this way. The cloud is now safer than what the banks can do. It's more reliable than the banks can do. I think it's just a mindset. I mean, I remember when back in 1995, we built our first internet-based service in financial services. People were like, the internet is not secure. And you had SSL at the time, which was the standard. Today, we all buy stuff all the time. We put our credit cards everywhere.
We look at our banking transactions, yeah.
You know, back then, people didn't even want to put their credit card information in. So just give it time and it evolves, right?
So the simple answer is it matured so much, actually, it's better quality now than the clients, unquote, quote unquote, in terms of the reliability. And then what about this challenge, which isn't an easy one to get around, which is that you've got this huge existing stacks in Citigroups or HSBCs or vast banks like that. They've got a million systems inside, and it's nice wrapping them up with APIs on the top, but you're still running through all these legacy stuff. That's obviously a challenge.
Yeah, it is. And I would say, you know, some of the big back office systems, they're going to probably stay the way they are, right? But the good thing about the cloud is you want to have, as you move some of your technology to it, you want to have to operate two technology stacks in parallel, because one is a stack that you have to operate, the other one is a stack that is completely out in the cloud. So you don't have to duplicate the technology in-house.
So your unit cost is going down the more that move over
there. Exactly. So what we'd encourage people to do is, as they build new things, migrate them over. You don't have to necessarily take the old stuff and try to re-engineer it. That can be difficult. There's a lot of constraints on large financial institutions on those old systems. But boy, for those new customer-facing bits, or you know, trader-facing, portfolio manager-facing, for those, please, come and get the cost savings.
Good. Well, thank you very much for that, Stefan. Time's gone by fast, as always, and I think you've explained it really clearly, really consistently about the advantages of this approach. And I think what really comes through is that somebody who spent 10 years working in this sector and 10 years refining your meal analogies and all this kind of thing, it ends up being simplified in the way that a good API gets simplified. And I can see why you guys are being so successful. And I wish you all good luck on your trillion calls in the first half of the year and 10 trillion in the second and 100 trillion next year. So thanks for coming today.
Thank you very much for having me. It was fun.
So those two initiatives I mentioned up front, both are designed to offset the overly one-way nature of podcasting. As someone who has listened to podcasts for years, I personally would love a chance to support my favourites and meet up with them and like-minded listeners, and I know many of you would too. The first initiative is a simple one. For some time, folks have been sending me kind feedback and asking how they can support the cause. Well, check out londonfintechpodcast.com/support. You can spread the word, leave a review on iTunes, and now donate towards the podcast. Patron-level donations will get special inside track content. The second is, for some time, folks have been asking for a London FinTech Podcast Live, exclusive member-only show in the real offline world. I've had a variety of ideas, from a breakfast or dinner to talk off record, and even more honestly about what's really going on, with a panel of guests and taking questions from the floor. Anyway, ideas vary, but live is the theme. So let me know what you want. Email me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com with your preferences around format and price point, and let's see what we can make happen.
Watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn. Watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the fire. firelight dance with me. Watch the firelight dance with me. Watch the firelight dance with me.